All right, we're going to be finishing chapter 31 in Genesis. And before we did that, and we talked about concubines a couple times, and I had some questions, so I just went and looked up what I could find. And so here's everything I know about concubines in the ancient Near East. And so, well, she's not the only one who's asked me questions about it. But so they really kind of were more seen as like a lower class wife, and I'm putting wife in quotes. And most of the time they were considered no more than just slaves or personal property. Most of the time they were slaves, but they were, you know, were a slightly higher status than a slave. In rare occasions, a concubine could be elevated to the status of wife, even becoming more of a full wife. But that didn't happen often, and it was usually particularly notable when it did. They were used in a variety of reasons, you know, to produce children. It was common in ancient Near East to do kind of what Abraham did, and Sarah went, oh, my wife can't have kids, so here, take this woman, she'll have kids, and they'll still kind of be ours. And then depending on how they felt about it, those children may or may not actually be their heirs. And so usually it was, you know, a fertility thing. There was also political, like, you know, think of King Solomon, how he had hundreds of concubines alongside his hundreds of wives. So sometimes there would be a political alliance that would go on here where, well, you know, you're not worthy enough for your daughter to become my wife and to marry me, but, you know, she can be one of my concubines. And so we'll do it that way. Or just a status symbol. So, you know, having more made you more important, it seemed. Having sex with a ruler's concubine, it was seen as an act of treason. This is something that Absalom, David's son, does. And so that's one of the many marks of his kind of rebellion and the civil war that leads in Israel. And so there's a variety, you know, there's some variety in the ancient world how this is used. And to be clear, the Bible does not say that this is godly or good behavior at all. It describes it happening, but it's nowhere endorsing it and saying this is great. It's almost always showing the consequences of it. So that's that, Genesis 31. So this is where Jacob is leaving, and so he is arising, he's going back to the promised land just like God commanded. So he's walking in obedience as God asked him to do, and so in 17 he arises, puts his sons and his wives on camels, and he drives away all his livestock and his property that he gained, and the livestock in his possession that he acquired to go to the land of Canaan. Okay, if you're messing with that, you need to turn the gain down. Yes, I'm talking to you. I'll tell you later. I mean, you can turn it down some. It's the gain. The guy, somebody came and fixed the speakers out there, but then he changed some stuff, and he said there would be some minor issues. If you select it, there's a little thing at the top. Never mind. I'm not going to. I can only explain one thing at a time. Right now I'm trying to explain Genesis 31. No, I'm sorry. I was trying to be helpful and then realized I couldn't do it. Only made it worse. So Jacob's leaving. He's going to the promised land. And so he's only taking his kids, his wife, and his property. And he is going to leave. And then we see that Rachel steals her father's household gods. So the household gods would be like their own idols. So every nation has their own gods. Laban's not a nation. Every people and every family might have their own gods as well. And so she takes her father's idols with her. So we'll come back to this. But it doesn't really tell us why she does this, so we don't know. I don't want to read too much into why she does it, only she shouldn't have done it. And whatever her reason was, it wasn't a good one. And it's going to cause some problems. And so Laban, I mean, we've seen kind of throughout his story, he has continually opposed Jacob. Their conflict is continuing to bubble up. So Jacob just leaving is the right thing to do. One, because, you know, that's just going to cause problems if he stays. Two, God's told him to leave. So he's obeying, and he leaves secretly. You know, it kind of says, yeah, he tricked him, so he waits. He doesn't tell them that he's leaving, but he packs and gets ready and then takes off. And you remember, too, they already have a good distance between them. Right, because Laban's moved their flocks apart, so they're not close, they're not seeing each other every day. So it takes Laban several days before he realizes that they're even gone. Laban, on the third day that Jacob has fled, finds out that he left. So then he takes his kinsmen with him, and they pursue and they chase him, but it takes them 7 days to catch up because they've got a good head start. Would you imagine how much faster Laban must be going? Because I don't think Jacob was lollygagging. I'm sure he was you know, trying to get out soon because he knew Laban would come after him. But if they're going quickly to catch up. But so they find him. But before he gets there, God appears to Laban in a dream and warns him. It's actually kind of funny what he warns him to do. He doesn't just say, leave Jacob alone. He says, be careful not to say anything to Jacob, either good or bad. So it's not just, don't you harm him. It's, you really don't say, you know what, Laban, just don't say anything. Which to me kind of sounds like God is saying, go home. What are you doing? You don't want to be having this conversation that you think you are. And so when they get there, Laban doesn't listen because he has lots of things that Laban wants to say. Laban overtakes Jacob, tells us where Jacob is at. And then in 26, he says, what have you done that you have tricked me and driven away my daughters like captives of the sword? So he accuses him of kidnapping his daughters, which we read last week that Jacob didn't do. He didn't command them. He didn't tell them. He didn't say, this is what we're doing. You better get along with it. He asked them. He said, hey, this is what's going on. God told me to leave. Your dad's not going to let me leave. I think we should leave. I want to obey God. What do you want to do? And they both said, no, we want to go with you. So he accuses them of kidnapping them. And then he also, you know, lies, you know, oh, why did you flee secretly and trick me and not tell me? That I would have, you know, I would have sent you away with mirth and songs and the tambourine and lyre. Why didn't you let me kiss my sons and daughters goodbye? This is such a foolish thing that you have done. As if Laban is just so upset. That's why he's chased him down for a week. It's because he just really wanted to, you know, have a party before he left. We know that's not what he would have done because this isn't how Laban has behaved towards Jacob at all. This is just him once again telling more lies through his teeth. And so he then, after that, you know, which he can't get his story straight. He's, oh, I'm so sad that you left, but it's my power to do you harm. So, you know, I really want to hurt you. I want to kill you. I want to take my family, all my stuff back. But the God of your father spoke to me last night and said, be careful not to say anything. But here I am saying things I probably shouldn't say. But because you've longed, you know, to go away from me, why did you steal my gods? And so there's this kind of this juxtaposition that's happening between the God of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and his power and the God of Laban, whose name we don't see and don't know. Jacob's God is powerful enough to show up in his enemy's dreams and to threaten them and to warn them. Laban's gods can be stolen and taken. It's showing the difference between the power on them here, I think. They don't have any voice, they don't have any power. And so Laban's complaining that his gods have been stolen away from him. You know, you longed greatly for a father's house. Okay, you wanted to go home, that's fine. But why did you steal my gods? And so Jacob answers and says, well, you know, I left because I was afraid that you would take your daughters away from me by force. Anyone in whom you find your gods shall not live. And in the presence of our kinmen, point out what I have is yours and take it. Because he didn't know that Rachel stole them. So he says, hey, well, I don't want those gods. And so anybody who has them, we'll kill them. That's fine. And then he also doesn't just say, you know, we'll execute whoever does this. He says, yeah, Laban, you're happy. You can take back whatever is yours. Go wander around through all the flock because mine are spotted and yours weren't and speckled. So it should be obvious if there's anything you've seen that you can say and point out to other people and they can all say, oh, yes, we know that's Laban's. Feel free to take that back. And Jacob's willing to say that because he knows he has not stolen a thing. He has been walking in obedience. He's been doing the right thing. He's not taken any of it wrongly. And so Laban, it kind of gives this long, it's all this stuff about his gods, which is just really kind of, at least I find it funny. Laban goes to Jacob's tent, and he goes into Leah's tent, and into the tent of two male female servants, but he can't find them. And he went out of Leah's tent and entered Rachel. So he's going all over the place, just trying to hunt these things down. Something was lost in our house recently. I won't say who lost it or what it was, and we were kind of doing this, going in all the rooms, and, you know, pulling out all the things, checking all the pockets, looking at all the clothes, trying to find what is missing. That's kind of what Laban's doing here. But so then he goes into Rachel's, and Rachel had taken the household gods, which we know, and she put them on the camel saddle, and she sits on them. And Laban, he's feeling all about the tent, but he can't find it. And then she says to her father, well, you know, don't let my lord be angry, but I can't rise up before you, for the way of women is upon me. So it's her time of the month. She's saying, yes, so I'm just going to sit here if that's okay. Then says it's okay, so he searches and he can't find the household gods. It's kind of a weird thing. Why is this happening? Well, there's a number of things going on here. One of the things is that camels, although this is before the Mosaic Law, so we don't have all of the laws about what is clean and what is unclean, but there's parts of that that are, you know, foreshadowed or then begin. And so one of the things that's unclean is a camel. Camels are unclean, so later in Israel's history, they won't have camels. Also, that whenever a woman is on her period, she is unclean. Well, really, anytime anyone is bleeding, they're unclean. And so Rachel is sitting on the unclean animal while she is unclean on top of these idols that are also unclean, I think is part of why we get all these extra details. Her behavior is wrong, sinful. You shouldn't do this. You shouldn't worship other gods. Jacob should know this. Isaac knows this, and he's talked about this, and God said, you know, I'll be your God, and you'll be mine here. Do, you know, obey me. But Rachel apparently wants other gods. But part of what's happening here, I think, is that Laban's gods are really just kind of shown to be powerless, and their best use is sanitation pads. It's the best thing that they could be used for, and about as useless as they are. And yet, even in the midst of this, part of what is significant and what's happening is that God is protecting Jacob. Okay, his father-in-law, who has been against him and who he has been fighting with and having all of this conflict for 20 years, could harm him. Seems to have more men, more armies, more power than him, and he could hurt him and kill him and take all of this away. But Jacob is obeying God, and he's, you know, trying to follow the path that God's asked him to, and God said that he will keep him safe. And here, God is keeping him safe, even though not everyone in his family is following after God as well. Even though there's sin in the camp. Even though his wife is stealing other gods. We don't know why, but she must be wanting to worship them. I don't know why else you'd want to take them. It's not like they're a fun decoration to have in the tent. And yet, even though that is happening, God is still protecting Jacob. And God is still protecting or keeping his promise. So I think that's kind of significant to see. And so now Jacob gets angry, which I would be too. And he berates Laban because he's like, okay, you looked all over and you can't find these and you accuse me of stealing these. And he says, what is my offense? What is my sin that you have hotly pursued me? You have felt through all my goods. And what have you found? Have you found all your household goods? Well, set it here before my kinsmen and your kinsmen, and they can decide between the two of us. He says, let's get everybody together. Let's get all our relatives. Let's get all of our men. Let's sit down. Let's have a trial, and let's decide who's in the right. You're accusing me of a lot of things. And then he goes on. He says, these 20 years I have been with you. That tells us how long this has been. It's not just, you know, that gives us somewhat of an idea of this kid back and forth, how that has gone. But so these 20 years I've been there, I've been working with him for that entire time, and Jacob has been faithful for 20 years in how he served Laban. And he goes on in detail of how your ewes and your female goats, they have not miscarried. Saying you've been incredibly blessed by God. That's a normal thing that would happen. You know, there's animals, you're not always going to have an easy birth where everything goes great. So while I've been with you, it's been awesome. Your livestock has increased greatly. You haven't lost anything to accidents over these 20 years. And he says, and I haven't eaten the rams of your flock. Now, I haven't taken advantage when I could have. I wasn't skimming off of the top. I wasn't taking some of your best animals and using them for lunch or for a good snack. And then he goes on at 39, says, and what was torn by wild beasts did I not bring to you? And I bore the loss of it myself. From my hand you required it, whether stolen by day or stolen by night. He said, anytime a single thing went missing, I paid for it out of my pocket. When your animals went missing, when someone stole them, when a creature came and ate them, or a lion or whatever, I paid for it. I replaced it. I took care of it. All out of his own pocket. Which is not, that's not right. That's not what should happen. He's saying he did that. And then there I was by the day of the heat that consumed me or the cold by night and the sleep fled from my eyes. So he's talking about all the suffering that he has endured. that he has clearly gone above and beyond and how hard he has worked and the conditions that he has worked for his really terrible father-in-law. Saying, these 20 years I've been in your house, I served you 14 years for your two daughters, 6 years from your flock, and you've changed my wages 10 times. So he's just going through the list of all the things that Laban has done against him. He's also saying, what's my sin? Here's what I have against you. What do you have against me? Laban doesn't really have anything that he can say. But so all of this has happened, and if the God of my father, the God of Abraham, and the fear of Isaac had not been on my side, surely now you would have sent me away empty-handed. So that's interesting what he does here. He's not blaming God. He's here thanking God and showing how God has been on his side even in the midst of this 20 years of suffering. Say, wow, God has been with me and I've been suffering for 20 years. I can't imagine what you would have done to me if God didn't keep me safe. You would have treated me even worse. You would have taken everything away from me. But God saw my affliction. God saw the labor of my hands, and God rebuked you last night. He knows and acknowledges that God sees. And this, we see this over and over in the scriptures. We see this again in Exodus, when Jacob's people will be stuck in slavery for hundreds of years, and it will say, and God saw them, and God heard their cry, and God acts. It's a reminder that God does see when his people suffer. He sees the affliction, that the way Laban has treated Jacob has not gone unnoticed. And all the labor that Jacob has done, every moment that he has spent faithfully serving his ungrateful, cheating, lying father-in-law, God sees, and God has noticed. And God has blessed him anyway. And it matters. And so God acts on his behalf, and God is protecting him, and that's why God showed up in Laban's dream. I think it's just it should be a reminder for us that when we suffer, God sees it. When we live faithful lives, honoring God, even as we are suffering, even as we are being mistreated, even if we don't think anyone notices, God does. And God sees it. And it matters. I think we can find comfort there. And so then Laban answers and says, well, the daughters are my daughters, and the children are my children, and the flocks are my flocks, and all that you see is mine. So that's Laban's contention. It's interesting, he's calling Jacob's wives his daughters, and Jacob's children, he's saying they're my children. And all those sheep that they already, again, negotiated over very clearly, and they split the flocks to make it clear whose was whose, and he says, no, they're all mine. Laban just still doesn't get it. He's just incredibly greedy and incredibly selfish, and he doesn't want to let anything go. Not a thing. So that's his position. He says, but what can I do this day for these my daughters or for these children whom they have borne? Come now, let's make a covenant. So he's acknowledging, I really want to kill you and take all this stuff because it's mine, but your God won't let me. So what are we going to do? And so even there, as he's protesting, he's saying, well, God's not changing his mind, but God is holding back Laban's hand. And so they begin to make this covenant. And so he says, let's make a covenant between you and I, and let it be a witness between you and I. So Jacob takes a stone, and he sets it up as a pillar. And Jacob says to a kinman, let's gather stones. And they get stones, and they put it into a big heap. 48, then this heap is going to be a witness between you and me. And so what are they doing here? They're not just setting up like a memorial stone that often happens, especially in the Old Testament. They're not just setting up something so they can have a monument and remember this day and the promises that they're going to make. They're also setting up a border. Okay, they're drawing a line in the sand. It's like when my children fight and I say, okay, Calvin, you go to your room, and Grant, you go over to your room. Here's the line. We're not crossing this. It's just some of what they're doing. They're putting these rocks and saying, okay, that side is Laban's side, and this side is Jacob's side. Don't cross it anymore. So they're putting up a border, which is often how these stones would be used. And so then they ask God and say, the Lord watch between you and me when we are out of one another's sight. I have heard this used at a wedding before. I've heard people use this like romantically or as an encouragement, like, oh, isn't this so nice? God is going to, you know, hope he watches over you while we're not together. This is more of a curse, is what they're asking. So I don't know if you were tempted to use this verse that way. You can, I guess, but it's not what it means. What he's saying is, okay, God's going to watch over you, and if you wrong me, God will punish you. That's what it's asking for. So while we're not watching each other, God is watching, and I hope he judges and strikes you dead if you do what we're not supposed to do. And then 50, if you oppress my daughters or you take other wives besides my daughters. So apparently now Laban has a problem with multiple wives. It's fine when they're both his daughters, but, you know, so it's kind of the hypocrisy there. Although no one is with us, see, God is a witness between you and me. That part Laban does get right. God does see, even if we think nobody sees. And then Laban says to Jacob, you see this heap and this pillar, I've set it up, it's a witness, and they kind of go over, and then here again in 52 is making it more clear, I won't pass over this heap to you, you don't pass over it to me either to do me harm. Interesting what Laban is saying. He's been threatening and threatening and threatening, but I think it's kind of clear how Laban is setting this up, that he's scared. That God, appearing to him and speaking to him and warning him, has shaken him. Then deep down now, Laban's starting to know, wow, he blessed me and he has all that stuff. I wonder if he could take the rest of my things. Okay, well, I got to protect myself. So this isn't really to protect Jacob. This is Laban trying to keep himself safe. And then in 53, there's this kind of juxtaposition between gods. It says, you know, the God of Abraham and the God of Nahor and the God of their father judge between us. And so Jacob swore by the fear of his father, Isaac. So this is pointing out that Laban might have seen God, and he might have even heard his voice, and he might be a little bit afraid of him, but he's not worshiping Yahweh. He's calling down other gods too, in his own household gods, in his personal family gods. So he's swearing by different names than who Jacob is swearing by. And Jacob gives God a very unique title. It's one of the only places this title for God is used. In this chapter is Jacob swearing by the fear of his father Isaac, or the terror would be another translation of it. And it's not just like fear of the Lord, like respect. Like here he's swearing, it's more of the idea of the fear that God puts into his enemies, or the fear that the enemies of God's people should feel. Is the title that Jacob uses for God. So it's this kind of unique name, which is the fear that Laban is feeling and facing. And so then they do that, and he offers a sacrifice in the hill country, and he calls his kinsmen to eat bread, and they eat bread, and they spend the night in the hill country. It's kind of foreshadowing of communion. I told you I had more than one point, so one way, and this is foreshadowing, right, is these meals that you would break bread together, and you would eat in order to make peace, to show that there is peace between us. So that's also part of what communion is. As we break bread, as we drink the cup, we are celebrating and showing the peace that God has made with us through the blood of Jesus. And so then, early in the morning, Laban arises. He kisses his grandchildren and his daughters, and he blesses them. And then Laban departs and turns home, and we don't have to see Laban anymore. And from then on, we'll turn to Jacob. So that's kind of the covenant they made. So some application here, what's going on. I think this shows us, you know, God can protect those who walk in his will. God told Jacob, return to the promised land, go back to your people, and I'll protect you and I'll be with you. And God's keeping his promises, even though Rachel is not behaving rightly. God keeps his promises anyway. And also, you know, it's a reminder that God sees those who are mistreated and he brings justice. He will do that always. He might not always do it in our lifetime. He might always do it when we see it, but he will do it. Of that we can have no doubt. That's our hope. And so when you are mistreated and when you are seeking justice, you can find hope and satisfaction that God sees it and God will act one day. And that our faithful labor, you know, it's not unseen and it won't go unrewarded. All those 20 years that Jacob spent there mattered. They did. I think about that for myself sometimes when I think about, when I was on staff at a mega church that was really a disaster in many ways, and there was a lot of things that were going on that were just so wrong and ungodly. And I think about the time that I spent working towards that and trying to honor the Lord there And verses like this are just a reminder of like, no, like, okay. What I was doing in trying to be faithful to God, even as I was being mistreated or abused, God saw it and it mattered. Now, it might not have mattered to the big organization or anything else, but God saw it. And so it's not worthless. And so I think that matters in our life too. When we are trying to be faithful to God, even if the work seems menial or meaningless and nobody sees it, it's not unseen. And it won't go unrewarded, at least not by God. So that's Genesis 31. Next week we'll have Jacob and Esau. Jacob wrestling with God. We won't get all the way to him meeting Esau yet. Any questions? Anything I can clarify? Yes?
Can you elaborate on why you think that Laban was swearing by other gods?
So it's using a different name for God there. So they don't translate it perfectly here, but he's using Elohim instead of Yahweh. Elohim is the more generic, just God. Yahweh is the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. So that, and then the fact that he says the God of Nahor, which is Abraham's father. Yes. Yahweh was not his God. So he must mean a different God and the God of, you know, their father. So it seems to me, that's where I'm.
Could it be he's just swearing by God in a more general sense and not the specific sense of it being Yahweh?
Possibly. That's not what the couple different scholars I read said. They all said it's him doing different gods. And the fact that he has household gods.
Yeah. Oh, I mean, obviously he's not.
You know. Yes. Good question. Yes. Perfect. I don't have to comment. No, it is. It's interesting. It makes me think of Melchizedek, too, because, I mean, so as we're going through Genesis, we're seeing the particular blessing that God is bringing through Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and Joseph. So that is the blessed covenant people. But it is through them the rest of the world is going to be blessed. And so you have Melchizedek, who is also experiencing the blessing of God, even though he's not part of that chosen particular people, but he has seen and heard of God and is worshiping him anyway. And that's how it's supposed to be, is that blessing is supposed to spread and others are invited to come and join it. And Laban's experienced the blessing of God for 20 years.
Yeah.
Over and over. He is only rich and only wealthy, not because he's a genius. He's clearly kind of a dummy. But God has blessed him. And yet 20 years after God blessing him and him knowing God has blessed him and him hearing from the God that he's, you know, he's never heard from his gods, but he's heard from Jacob's God. And yet he still is like, no, I think this is all my stuff and I think I'm going to do what I want to do. So. No, there's God. God blesses so many people in the world, and he reveals himself. I mean, he's revealed himself here in a number of other ways, and yet it's not enough for many. No.
At all.
Neither is Jacob. So ultimately, and that's where we have to remember, you know, it's not that Jacob's a genius, Laban's an idiot. Ultimately, it's just God's grace, and if we're going to respond to it or not. I mean, he had a choice. He's very clearly making the wrong choice over and over. No, it doesn't, which is remarkable. That's kind of the, I don't know. People have this wrong perception of the Old Testament that, like, Jesus is very kind and loving, but God is so cruel. But when you understand what, like, justice and fairness is, which is, okay, every time you do any sin at all, dead. That's justice. And then eternal punishment forever. That is the right. It's not wrath. That's just justice. So anything short of that is grace and mercy. And over and over and over, we see God show mercy. Like there, he just doesn't, it doesn't ever touch this again. We don't know what conversation Jacob and Rachel had. We don't know if Jacob ever found out. We know God found out. But, you know, we just see his grace. So I hope we don't lose sight of that. Okay, good comments. I'll pray for us, and then we can keep chatting about other things or this too. Lord, I just thank you that you are a merciful and a gracious God, that you were gracious enough to reveal yourself to us in your word, through your prophets, through dreams, through visions, and through your son Jesus, that you came down and walked among us, that you spoke our language and you talked to us and you revealed yourself to us. And you were willing to humble yourself in that way. Lord, would you help us to not have hard hearts? Would you help us to recognize the grace and the mercy that you've shown us? Would you help us to respond to it in the right way? Respond to it in faith and respond to it in gratitude. And I pray this in your very holy and precious name. Amen. All right. Thanks for being here tonight.